The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning. You have joined We the People Radio with Aaron, Bill, Bob.
Morning, Aaron. Morning, Bob.
Morning, Bill.
Morning, Aaron.
Why do we always say Bill? Why do we have to say it like that?
I don't know. It's almost either. Like Newman.
Newman.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, how's everybody doing?
Bill.
Hello, Bill.
There you go.
Kind of drag it out and have that, you know, disdain.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of a little chaotic this morning.
Yeah, it's a little hot, too. Our AC was off. I think our AC got flipped to heat last night.
Oh, man, it's evil.
Yeah,
all right. That's
all right.
Well, while Bob calls the ambassador, we will tell you about the ambassador because we only have him for an hour. So we're going to pile on this hour. If you'd like to read more about what's going on, you'd like to join us on the chat room, wethepeopleradio.us, and Robert has a great page up with all the good stuff for this morning. So the first hour here from 8 to 9, we have Ambassador Francis Rooney. He served as the United States Ambassador to the Holy See. And for those of you that don't know the Holy See, that's the Vatican and the Pope.
That's the Pope.
Under George W. Bush from 2005 to 2008, he's the chief executive officer of Rooney Holdings Incorporated. His new book is called The Global Vatican. And Ambassador Rooney provides an unprecedented look inside the Catholic Church, its role in world politics and diplomacy, and the extraordinary relationship between the United States and the Holy See. It's a topic, I guess, that most people, I guess if you're not Catholic, you don't really...
You don't really know.
You don't necessarily follow what's going on in the Vatican other than when Pope John Paul passed away, then we had the election of the Pope, and that's always something that brings a lot of people forward, take a look at what's going on in the church and the traditions and those kinds of things. And I've been to the Vatican, and it's a neat place, and I'm jealous. I can't imagine if you're the ambassador, you get to go to all the fun things.
I remember when Nancy Pelosi went and embarrassed us all. That was fun.
I forgot about that.
Yeah,
I tried to forget about that.
Yeah.
So do we have Ambassador Rooney on the line?
He's here.
We do. We got everybody situated. We finally got everyone in the studio sitting down. We have our computers up. Holy cow. Ambassador Rooney, we gave people a little bit of a sneak peek at your biography, but we didn't tell them any of the good stuff. We left that all for you.
Although there's some good stuff.
Although our good friend Stephen Manfredi, he gave us a list of like 10 possible questions, and I thought, well... We're going to need him here.
Hey, you gave away my secret weapon.
Several hours.
I was going to ask questions and make it sound like it came off the top of my head.
Yeah, well, that's
I can't
over.
Be all smart.
That's over. But you know, the one thing in the questions that we didn't know was that in your book, The Global Vatican, you said that full diplomatic relations with the Vatican were only established by Ronald Reagan in 1984. I don't think most people would know that.
Now, prior to that time, you know, the conditions in the United States politically were not acceptable to doing that. You know, the anti-Catholic prejudice that I try to write about in the book that began in the early 19th and late 18th centuries, right after the foundation of the country, kind of culminated with the election of President Kennedy. And after that, it started to go down, and then you had the obvious rise of Pope John Paul as a major power player against communism, and Ronald Reagan could leverage that.
And then were you there during when he passed away and then Pope Benedict was elected? Were you there at that time or just after?
Just after.
Okay. All right. Yeah, we went to the Vatican, my mom and I. We were there 2 weeks, I think, after Benedict came in. So.
Okay.
We were never there prior, but boy, there was sure a footprint left.
Oh, yeah. I was at the State Department studying Italian the day Pope Benedict was selected.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So now, when you're the ambassador to the Vatican, how much time do you spend at the Vatican? Do you spend most of your time there, most of your time here? Or?
No, mostly full-time. It's a full-time ambassadorial post. just like any other embassy to a secular country.
So you're there most of the time, huh?
Oh, yeah, other than coming back to the United States to see the kids or
right.
for a little vacation or something, yeah.
Okay, that's pretty fun.
You know, the anti-Catholic sentiment in the United States, I know it's where did it start? I mean, or why did it start, I guess? You know, they are the largest, or one of the largest religions in the world, and I guess I don't understand how that got started in the United States.
You know, Bill, that's an interesting question, because, and I tried to outline it in the book, Maryland was founded as a Catholic colony. You know, kind of like Rhode Island was a Congregationalist one,
right.
Virginia was kind of an Anglican stronghold. A lot of the colonies, leaders of the colonies, brought their particular faith, majority faith, with them. And Maryland was founded to be a Catholic state, and it didn't take more than about 60 or 70 years before the anti-Catholic prejudice that resulted from the Enlightenment took over. And as I wrote in the book, John Carroll and his cousin Daniel, who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were unable to vote in their own state by 1776.
Wow.
I think it had a lot to do with the Enlightenment scholars, you know, John Locke, Rousseau, Voltaire, who were repulsed by the church because of its alignment with the monarchies of Europe. And they were anti-monarchist at heart. And so what I try to show in the book is that they were anti-monarchist, and they rejected the church in the late 1700s. In mid-1700s, even though their teachings are almost word for word what the church had been preaching and teaching since the time of St. Thomas Aquinas.
Interesting.
And so why that long standoff, I guess?
Well, then you went from that kind of prejudice to the rise of the immigrants, you know, the Irish and Italian immigrants that came over. And, you know, immigrants are always kind of prejudiced against, and these were predominantly Catholic ones back then, either from Eastern Europe, you know, the Poles and Lithuanians that came to Chicago and Pennsylvania, and the Irish and Italians that came to the Northeast, and mostly the Northeast, I guess, originally. But finally, you know, it all kind of culminated with the election of John Kennedy, and you can, political scientists have graphed the anti-Catholic sentiment in the electorate, and it peaks with John Kennedy.
It's funny. I mean, who would think that we didn't have relations with the Pope? Because that's a gold mine, actually. I mean, a great Pope, especially like John Paul, who has the ability to have so much influence. I can't imagine not doing that. But there are quite a few. Stephen gave us quite a few cheat notes for you. I guess we have really distanced ourselves, and that's what we see here, but we're not ambassadors, so what do we know? It looks like the Obama administration has very little to do with the Pope.
Well, there's no doubt that the president has conducted the most secular administration in history. At least it seems to me there's no doubt. I mean, even more than Bill Clinton. And as a result of being so secular, he certainly has had little to do, a little interest with the role the Holy See can play in the world, which is a real shame. You know, previous presidents have leveraged the Holy See's voice in the world on certain areas of mutual interest. Obviously, there are people like Reagan, George Bush, his father, there was more interest, but even Bill Clinton leveraged and had a more robust relationship with the Holy See than Obama.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about that is you can't really take that personal, because he's not really involved with a lot of the countries throughout the world, his administration, and I think we're reaping the benefit of that now. And you look at that and compare it to somebody like Reagan, who was very involved with other countries and ambassadors everywhere, and look at where we were in the world then.
Yeah, it's a sad state.
Well, when you were there under the Bush administration, what were the primary things that you wound up doing? Like, when you look back, maybe things that we didn't hear about.
Well, the first thing was, of course, to mutate continued criticism of our engagement in Iraq. The Vatican had been a vocal opponent of the second Iraq invasion, and for some reasonably good reasons. They don't necessarily say we shouldn't have invaded, but some of the things that they were concerned about have, in fact, come to happen. Empowering Iran, helping Iran do things to Iraq that Iran wasn't able to do on its own, increasing persecution of Christians, et cetera, et cetera. So my job was to make sure that these lingering voices were silenced. And I did that by trying to build bridges to the people who were most anti-U.S. at that time and try to build a relationship that would make it more difficult for them to want to speak up against us. And that worked pretty well. And then, of course, the other thing was leveraging the Pope's willingness to speak up so strongly against the radical Islamicists, and trying to link that and leverage that to President Bush's global war on terror was another important facet.
So I bet you're not very happy with the way we're going now.
No. And fortunately, Pope Francis has recently spoken up against ISIS and the business about trying to establish a caliphate. And he even mentioned the just war theory, which I think is a really useful comment for him to make. That was what was cited to justify the Vatican's tacit acceptance of the first Iraq invasion, but it was also cited to explain the Vatican's opposition to the second one.
Well, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask you about that. When he made that comment here just in the last few weeks about, sometimes military force is necessary, I thought that was a huge, huge statement on the part of the Vatican.
Yeah, it's very useful. And the just war theory is similar to General Eisenhower's rules of engagement. You know, they're almost parallel when you get right down to it. They're just in different language. It calls for having a threat which is more than just the threat of one sovereign. You know, you don't go in and take out just a sovereign. You have to have a supernumerary threat, which is part of the problem with Iraq, but it's not the problem now. You need a community of nations to support the effort, not just one or two, which was a bit of a problem with Iraq too, but was not a problem with Iraq 1 or Afghanistan, and it's certainly not a problem now. And then the third thing you need is you need proportionality, which means the level of harm you're going to inflict is roughly relatively equal to the amount of harm that the aggressor's inflicting. And that was something that, you know, was why Iraq 1, you know, where once Saddam Hussein quit, we quit, instead of just mowing them all down. And the feeling was that in the second Iraq invasion, at least from part of the Vatican, that a full-fledged assault and takeover of the country was not necessarily proportional to the goal of taking out the bad guys who killed Americans in 9/11. And there's some truth to what they said in that respect. So, you know, here we have a situation that is so vile that almost any level of threat could be argued to be proportional to what ISIS and Syria have been doing to people in the last few years.
Well, yeah, because now it's about every other religion other than Islam they're at war with. So
and really, half of Islam they're at war with too, because they hate the Shiite about as much as they hate us.
That's true. There's probably more Muslim victims than anybody else right now, but they are coming after everybody.
Well, and at the end of the day, one of the implicit significant enemies of Al Qaeda and ISIS is the Arab monarchies, you know, the Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, etc. And Osama bin Laden used to make that clear that he was against them, and that's part of why Saudi Arabia has behaved so strangely in many ways that we can talk about. But right now, we have this non-state actor. My hope is that this becomes an opportunity to draw the Arab states into the direct conflict. And, you know, they're the people closest to the football field. They need to put some pads on and play as well.
Well, I think that's the big stumbling block right now. And it seems like they're the only ones that don't want to get involved directly right now. They want everybody else to come in and kind of clean up the mess. But it's their game. I mean, they're going to be the ones impacted first by letting this go. They've got huge skin in the game.
It's been the history that we've allowed them, we've enabled them, kind of like they said, enabling like a drug addict or something.
Sure.
Yeah. We've enabled them to be passive in their backyard and to export their Wahhabism to other countries to buy peace at home, all of which is bad stuff. And Now, you know, you've got King Abdullah speaking up against radical Islam right there in Saudi Arabia and encouraging the Muslim clerics in Saudi Arabia to speak up against it too. And just last week, Abdulaziz, who's the head imam of Saudi Arabia, said that, you know, terrorism like ISIS has no place in Islam. So there's a few good sprouts starting to spring out of the dirt here, but we still got a long way to go.
Do you think having the Pope speak out more on this would help bring a coalition out to help fight this situation?
Undoubtedly, especially in the Western nations, the Pope, and in Latin American nations, the Pope gives huge cover to a politician whose people may be more pacifistic and not realize the threat. The Pope helps that situation out a lot. He also gives argument to the just war theory, which by calling for the community of nations, you know, creates a rationale for bringing NATO in and bringing Western Europe in and also bringing in the states closest to the conflict. I don't think there's any doubt that they can be a constructive voice here.
Right, right. Well, talk to us about the numbers. What's the numbers of Catholics throughout the world in some of these other countries?
Yeah, because it seems like lately, you know, they're... I guess I haven't noticed any difference in particularly in church attendance, but I have since I was a kid. I'm 53, and I grew up on the East Coast, and, I mean, it was shoulder to shoulder. I remember because there was no air conditioning.
You know, so you think sweaty
about,
shoulders.
Think about the summer, and it's like, if we're not there early, it's gonna be horrible. So how have you seen that play out, especially in the time that you were the ambassador?
Well, I put some stuff about this in the book. The church attendance, as you know, has gone steadily downhill in the United States and all the Western world. And our statistics are masked by the Hispanics because they have been growing and their church attendance is higher than ours. So it makes the United States look like a much higher, higher attending nation than it really is if you take the non-Hispanic Catholic population. I think there's like 1.1 billion, 1.2 billion Catholics in the world, but the fastest growing areas are in Africa and somewhat in Asia, but certainly Africa is the fastest growing. And there's even been an inroads by evangelicals in Latin America. I heard a statistic that I'm not sure of, but that Guatemala was like majority evangelicals now.
Wow. And, you know, you talk about Africa being on the grow. I mean, you would think that having strong diplomatic relations with the Catholic Church would do nothing but help us in those areas because, I mean, that's a war-torn region.
It is, and who better than the Pope with his soft power platform to speak out against terrible governments like Zimbabwe and the Christian-Muslim fight in Central African Republic and the fight of everybody against each other in Darfur. Three different sets of Muslims, plus Christians, you know. I mean, the Pope's in a unique position to say, enough of all this, you know. This is totally inhumane on all parts.
Right. You know, you use the term soft power. Tell us what that's about. Where'd you come up with that?
Soft power is the power of influence and persuasion instead of coercion. You know, you use the moral force of your arguments. You use the ability to build bridges and relationships to gain understanding of other people rather than brute force. And it has a role to play in the world, and I think it has an increasingly accepted role to play now, given the nature of the conflicts that we see that are first of all, they're asymmetrical. It's not just pitch battle. And B, that it seems to have all these religious and tribal and cultural overtones, which leads right into, you know, building cultural bridges and using soft power. The State Department's recently inaugurated an initiative called cultural diplomacy to try to harness some of these similar threads and figure other ways to reach people where they can't reach them otherwise through force. We've even seen Rouhani in Iran and Putin in Russia, although I don't necessarily trust their motives, calling for soft power solutions instead of arms. Of course, they're calling for soft power so someone doesn't bomb them. You know, but.
Right.
Yeah, we were being nice. What? Way to hide behind it. The term under Pope Benedict was really different. I mean, it was even different if you were Catholic in this country. He made some really sweeping changes.
Yeah, you know, a lot of Catholics feel that Pope Benedict was just extremely conservative, too conservative for the day that we live in, American Catholics, okay? But when you look at him from a diplomatic point of view, and you look at his willingness to speak up against the global war on terror, and speak up with such a historical and philosophical orientation, I think he provided a useful service. Certainly provided a useful service to the administration of George Bush in leveraging the global war on terror. He also spoke up against secularism in a deep, profound way that goes back to early civilization and the role of natural rights of man and creating essential human dignity as being essential for good civic behavior that other people have not ever articulated quite so clearly. So in that respect, I really think he made a huge contribution. I tried to explain that in the book. I hope I did a good job of it.
He was probably, I'm not going to say our smartest pope in a long time, because that's a really pejorative term, but he was very, very scholarly.
He was certainly the most scholarly and the most intellectual.
Yeah, and I think that went over. I think that went over people's heads a little bit. I think they liked the little bit more personal touch. What was he like to work with? Like, what kind of people did he surround himself with?
Well, he's a very nice, gentle, kind, pastoral person. Not at all unlike the way the media portrayed him up front, but. He wasn't a great administrator, and how many philosophers are great administrators?
Mm.
And really, that's an issue with the papacy generally. There hasn't been a really good administrator since Paul VI, who came from a noble family, was used to families that had property and people on the payroll and, you know, checks to be cut and things like that. You know, Pope John the 23rd's family were goat herders, and John Paul, you know, was from the mountains of Poland, So now it looks like we have Pope Francis, who's a better administrator than Pope Benedict. He's made some really good appointments, where Pope Benedict made some appointments that turned out to be a little disappointing, and he lost control over a couple of things like the Vatican Bank. And now I think Pope Francis is going to fix a lot of that, and he's brought in a couple of American cardinals, particularly Cardinal Worrell and Cardinal O'Malley, who are really capable in this area and can really add a lot of value in fixing these problems.
It's funny. I don't think most people really know about or understand things like the Vatican Bank.
Right. And that got me to thinking, does the United States, does the Catholic Church in the United States have much influence with the Vatican?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. It certainly, especially right now, because if you saw the articles in the papers, at the time of the election of Pope Francis, they mentioned the big Red Room meeting at the North American College where all the cardinals were speaking out against what we needed in a pope, and I think they had a lot to do with his selection. The influence of America has always been there, but the Europeans resist it, and they try to keep it down. But even as far back as Vatican II, you know, when the European clerics, who were so conservative and opposed Dignitatis Humanae and Nostra Aetate, that recognized other faiths and all that kind of stuff, it was the Americans led by John Courtney Murray, a Jesuit, and in a union with the Eastern European prelates who lived under abridgments of religious freedom, and said, you can't give religious freedom to some people, not to everybody, that got those documents approved. And so, you know, there's always this anti-U.S., pro-monarchist European sentiment that's lurking in there, but they can't get away from the fact that the U.S. gives a preponderance of the resources to the church and has a huge, third largest Catholic population in the world.
Do you think we'll ever see an American pope?
I'm sure we will. I think Pope Francis is certainly a good warm-up to the refreshing value of looking to the new world for leadership.
That's true. He doesn't go to old world Europe anyway. We need to take a really, really quick break. We'll be right back. We are speaking with Ambassador Francis Rooney. Kind of forgot to put that in there in the meantime. People have been listening for a half hour. I hope you figured it out. We are talking about his book, The Global Vatican, and his experience as ambassador under the Bush administration, 2005 to 2008, or the years we're focusing on. If you have questions, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back. What shall we do about them? Soul, then it's just your body, then they go.
you look down upon me, Jesus. You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. I won't make it any other way.
Good one, Bob. See, music for every occasion. what do you play when you have the former ambassador to the Holy See on the interview? It's a little tricky.
It is tricky.
We do so much with environmental policy and lots of things like that, lots of political topics that this almost verges on the we can't really joke around. But I guess we could. They probably joke around at the Vatican.
Those guys have senses of humor, too.
I was going to say, they probably goof off at the Vatican a little bit, don't they?
Well, in their circumscribed way. I remember when Mrs. Bush wanted to come head up the Olympics in 2005, and the White House called and said, you know, we need you to set up a private meeting with the Pope and Mrs. Bush. And up to that point, the Pope had never seen any person other than a head of state or an accredited ambassador or a large group. So I went in to see the Secretary of State, and I explained the situation, and he said, well, you know, Pope's never seen anybody like that, but let's see what we can do. And then 2 days later, we were in a receiving line with the Pope, and I go up to him, and I, you know, shake hands and whatnot, and he looks at me with a twinkle in his eye and says, I guess we're going to see Mrs. Bush, aren't we? And I said, well, if you say so, you're the boss. You know, he laughed. He just went crazy. You know, no one ever talked to him like that, I don't think. But,
and it's funny, you don't think of him being a funny guy, but there are a lot of pictures of him smiling, and you can really tell. You can tell he probably had a pretty good sense of humor. He was super smart.
Well, I would imagine I would imagine he is pretty closely guarded, and I don't imagine it would be possible for anybody to just walk up and shake his hand.
No, this was the receiving line of the diplomatic corps. No, you can't get in there and do that. He's guarded just like the president or anybody else. I mean, the whole apostolic palace is kind of fairly high security. And the guy that runs the security there, Dr. Johnny, you'll see him whenever the Pope's walking around in one of these visits. Very, very well-schooled, excellent professional security officer trained in the Italian security forces, and he just runs a fantastic operation to protect the Pope.
Well, yeah. And the Swiss Guard, I mean, those guys, my mom wanted to take a picture with one of the Swiss Guard, and they were like, no.
Well, we were talking to our local parish priest last week. He was back.
We tried to get him to sit in with us, but he had mass, darn it. We saw him last night. We're like, job. You could change your mind.
He was there for
the canonization.
Oh, that's right. That's
he was
right.
All excited. He was number 46, so he snuck into all sorts of good stuff.
Well, but he was talking to us about some of the security and some of the stuff that he attended, and it really did remind me of going to an event with somebody like the president. I mean, you had to really jump through hoops, get background checks. I mean, even the priests were checked pretty thoroughly before they even got close. I was impressed.
Well, you know, there's nothing to say that someone couldn't interpose as a priest, just like they can interpose as in any other thing. In fact, as I put in the book, during the Cold War, East Germany, and I think it was the Ukraine, did in fact do that. They infiltrated the Vatican.
Hmm.
Oh, that's not good.
And recently, you know, ISIS has said we need to consider the Pope a mortal enemy, just like the United States and everybody else. Because, you know, you think about it, when I was in Rome, the Holy See was considered one of the leading highest security risk positions because of the risk of these radical Islamists wanting to catch the U.S. and the Church at the same time.
Well, and you were there just 4 years after 9/11, so I would imagine things were still incredibly tense. I don't think that's ever really
gone back.
No,
we had a couple of bomb threats and a couple of people trying to get in, scale the wall at the embassy and things like that, and had a fairly high level of security.
How do you feel about the Pope not using the Pope-mobile for cover when he's out amongst the masses? You think that's
yeah,
really?
Yeah, you got to worry about it. I hate for anything to happen to him. I mean, it's obviously stimulated a lot of people, the ability to get that close to the Pope and feel him as a human, which used to be that way with presidents and popes and everybody, and now everything's so attenuated because of security risks.
Right.
I would just hate anything to happen to him.
I know. I've seen a lot of pictures of him just right down with the people.
The security people are just
on edge when he does that. But he doesn't seem to be intimidated or afraid to go out and really get right in the middle of it.
So, no, he doesn't.
So, Ambassador, who has the great, really great working relationship, you know, historically great relationship with the Holy See? I mean, it hasn't been us.
Well, I think it's evolved over time. Obviously, you know, in the early years of the Middle Ages and things, you know, it was kind of a constant struggle between France and Germany. And then you had the rise of England, which was important for a short time, but not so much after Henry VIII, obviously.
Yeah.
And around the same time as Henry VIII came the rise of Spain with Felipe II and the wealth of the New World. It was the wealth of the New World that actually built St. Peter's in the 16th century through Philip II of Spain. So they were hugely powerful for a long time. And now in the modern era, I would have to say the United States has exerted a fair bit of influence in the Holy See. If you read my book, you'll see that we had a very strong relationship with the Holy See all during World War II. Franklin Roosevelt realized the ability of the Holy See to be useful to American policy interests during the war, and he leveraged it by sending a personal representative there. Then, of course, the Cold War stuff took the relationship to a whole new level. And even Obama's secularism has not been able to undermine the broad respect that foreign policy thinkers and other states have for the role the Holy See plays in the world. So I think Obama's going to be a temporary aberration here.
Yeah.
It's a shame that we don't have a little stronger relationship there.
Especially with everything that's going on. I mean,
Secretary Kerry gets it, and he's made a few trips over there and to talk to his counterpart, Secretary of State Paroline.
Well, that's useful, I guess, as we head into this mess, because if we don't deal with, well, and how about Israel, I guess, before I forget that, because the next hour we have a guy on who is part of the global security, he does global security work, but specifically he works with Israel. He is from Israel, and last week he called us, gave us a little update from his Humvee on the border of Gaza, so...
The Middle East is hugely complex, and the Israeli Palestinian aspect of it is no less complex than Sunni Shiites or anything else. I mean, you know, the Pope's trip to Israel was groundbreaking in the sense that he went to Jordan, and then he went to Bethlehem, and he went to Israel. I don't think other popes have ever had a multi-stop visit when they went to call on the government of Israel. And I think it was controversial in Israel, and the Pope did some things that were controversial that we could talk about. But I think it was healthy that he went to Jordan because, you know, Jordan's kind of become the stepchild of the United States in this Middle East, in this Syria-Iraq situation. And it would be a horrible shame for Jordan to become undermined and weakened because of the tons of refugees that have fled there from Iraq and Syria and because of the number of bad guys that are probably lurking around in some of those refugee communities. King Abdullah is a huge ally of the United States. And so that was good. Now, then he went to Bethlehem. And that was theological, you know, the birthplace of Jesus. Then he went and kissed the wall between Israel and Bethlehem. The wall's been a source of great consternation for Palestinians and Christians because the Christians happen to all live in Palestinian areas, and a lot of them in Bethlehem, and it's hard to get back and forth to Israel. But on the other hand, you look at the number of suicide bombers that wall has repulsed, you've got to say that a little inconvenience might not be so terrible to make sure that more innocent people aren't killed by radicalized Islamic suicide bombers.
True story.
How was he received when he went over there, went to Israel? I mean, up front, I think what everybody sees, he was received with open arms. But how was that? I mean, was it a little chilly?
Well, I think he was received well. I mean, except for, I mean, maybe privately, you know, that he might have been spoken with by Naya or somebody about the the Jordan and Bethlehem wall situation. There was some press in Israel against his stopping at the wall and saying a prayer. Not the Wailing Wall, but the wall between Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequent to meeting with Netanyahu, I think it was that last day when he went and met with the imam at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, I think that definitely steamed up the Israelis a little bit.
But not doing that just leaves the door open for more problems. How much of a you know, if the U.S. and the Vatican really teamed up and really, you know, really put their best foot forward, let's say, what's the potential?
Well, I think the potential is to have the Holy See influencing people that the U.S. can't because of its position, and I think the potential is for the U.S. to take the Holy See's message and deploy it in a more tangible way, as is the potential for Israel to do it. You know, I mean, I would say to Israel about the Al-Aqsa Mosque visit, you can't visit with him, so why not have the Pope do it? You know, look at how the Pope Benedict spoke up bluntly against radical Islam and brought a bunch of Muslim clerics out of the woodwork who basically admitted that Islam's got to come into the modern world and can't live in the 12th century. You know, that we're not going to go back to the Stone Age just to suit them.
And that truly is what they want. And looking at what's going on lately, I just, nobody can support
just
that.
Just doesn't make sense.
Nobody
really
can support
doesn't.
Any of that.
Yeah. See, I think the Pope and his emissary to the Middle East, Archbishop Filoni, who used to be the Holy See's ambassador to Iraq, so he's very knowledgeable, I think there's a role they can play in meeting with people that it obviously certain states can't do in an open way in that area.
Does Israel have an ambassador?
To the Holy See, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I would
imagine. Yeah, we have a strong, I had a very strong relationship with my counterpart from Israel, and we worked on many things together, especially during the 2006 Lebanon War.
That's right, I forgot about that one. So in order to become the ambassador and go there and, you know, be able to do a good job, what were you doing prior?
I was running a group of international companies. We have a group of companies that work in Latin America and Central America, the United States, and I've always been involved in Republican politics. Knew President Bush, and there have been some things in the first administration for him, some official visits to different things, and a couple of commissions and here and there. And so, come the re-election, he offered this position. I was really thankful for the opportunity to serve him.
I bet it was amazing. I mean, what an amazing place to get to see the inside. What was some of the stuff that you didn't expect?
Well, I think I didn't know enough about what to expect or not expect from the local priests there that work in the Secretary of State's office. But what I found was they were incredibly knowledgeable. I mean, you know, they're organized just like our State Department with various desks of each different Monsignor has a responsibility for countries the way our desk officers do. And they're incredibly knowledgeable about what's going on all around the world, all the nuances of policy issues in each of these countries. And they do it with a very small staff. I was amazed at that. And I was also really thankful to learn that a lot of these guys who are involved in their foreign policy apparatus are just as pastoral and everything as a great parish priest, and many of them will probably just assume be somewhere in Northern California preaching to a nice flock of Catholics that are doing what they're doing. But they consider this the use of the talents God commissioned them to deploy.
So it isn't just hardcore politics?
No, there's always a little bit of that, especially when you've got a lot of Italian clerics involved.
Yeah. It almost sounded like you said we could get a lot done with a lot smaller staff in our country.
Well, I asked Cardinal Turan, who's a very senior diplomat in the Holy See, high up in the Secretary of State's office one time, how come a staff of 100 or 150 can do what it takes so many more people in the State Department to do? It's not that anyone's more intelligent than the other. It's just that, as he said to me, well, we're priests. We don't have any outside distractions other than our work.
Oh, yeah,
they're 24/7 focused on whatever their part of the curia is commissioned to do.
Well, the part that we've listed on our webpage about your book, The Global Vatican, for starters, the cover is beautiful, but it says here it's part memoir, part historical lesson, and it captures the braided nature, which I thought was a great descriptor of the religious and political power and the complexities and the battles and the future prospect. And going into this future with this Islamic, I mean, it's never been this. Well, I mean, I guess we had the Crusades. It has been bad before.
Well, the new news here is that we haven't faced a religiously inspired, or at least religious metaphor inspired, force like this probably since the Crusades. All of our other conflicts have been with hegemonic states or groups that wanted to become hegemonic states.
What do you see going forward? What could the U.S. do to really to help themselves? Because we're headed for something, I think, probably bad. Who's our ambassador to the Holy See right now? And what are they doing that we see?
Well, our ambassador to the Holy See is named Ken Hackett. He's a really good guy. He used to run Catholic Relief Services in Baltimore, and I think he's doing a really good job. But his job's much different than mine was, because I had George Bush, who had such serious interest in leveraging the Holy See in all opportunities and in knowing what the Holy See thought about a wide range of issues. So for me, it was very robust. I think that Ambassador Hackett is doing a great job, and he's advancing U.S. interests where he can, but it can't be as robust as it was with George Bush. I can't imagine how it could be.
Yeah. And what is it that we don't see here that is kind of, there's always a facet of everyone's work that isn't promoted, and it's unfortunate because people miss a lot. What would you like people to know?
Well, one of the things about working in the Holy See is a lot of the best things that we do together, just like in many ambassadorial missions, are either classified or otherwise not subject to disclosure.
Oh.
And you know, there's things that we've gotten the Holy See to do for us that really can't really be described. And there's things that we've told the Holy See, information we've exchanged with the Holy See. You know, some of the stuff about John Paul II and Gorbachev and the weapons being amassed at the Polish border by the Russians and Secretary Casey coming over and showing those maps to the Pope, or Vernon Walter showing those maps to the Pope. All that stuff's declassified now, so you can get a feel for some of the things that happened, because in an attempt to bring the Holy See into these situations and leverage their network. I mean, and they do have a vast network of information that it's important for the United States to tap into and receive. They know a lot of things sometimes that we don't know through their Catholic hierarchy, NGOs, nuns, Catholic hospitals, etc.
Interesting, because you don't hear much. You know, it seems like anymore, though, the way our media does things, we don't hear about things unless there's some sort of scandal. So I guess not hearing about the ambassador is probably a good thing.
Yeah, he's working quietly and effectively in many ways. I really respect him for his service. In some ways, his job is much more difficult and complicated than mine was.
Yeah, that's true. He is bridging probably a greater divide in a way. So what really prompted you to write the book? Because it's not an easy thing to do.
No, it took 3.5 years, and as a priest friend of ours in Notre Dame said, he said, it's going to take you over 3 years, and it's going to take a lot more work than you can ever imagine. He was right about both points. But I wrote the book because I would speak a little bit when we got back about, you know, the U.S. role and the Holy See in the world and things, and I found that people really had no knowledge of the role the Holy See has played in international affairs and in diplomacy over the years. So I thought, well, maybe this is a contribution that I can make to both U.S. diplomacy and diplomacy at large, and to the respect that the Holy See has in the world, because I think their voice is important. And it's also important that people realize that the United States has a great deal to gain from a vibrant relationship with them. So those are the two fundamental macro arguments of the book.
So for people who are concerned that the Catholic Church has too much power, or that their intentions maybe you're not representative of what we would be looking for in the world. I don't happen to hold that view, but you do hear that. What would you say to those folks?
Well, I would say, you know, I did a talk at AEI here last winter, and a girl came up at the end of it and said, well, I'm an atheist. Why should I read your book?
Oh, there you go.
And I said, well, you know, if you believe in human rights, you believe in freedom, religious or otherwise, and you believe that people are endowed with inalienable rights, natural rights from their creator, is the precursor of this human rights, human dignity thing, then you ought to read my book and find out that the Holy See stands for these principles for everybody, you and me. And she said, well, maybe I will go read your book. So, who knows?
You probably lost her when you got to the inalienable rights from God. I think she probably drifted a little bit.
She wanted
there.
The inalienable rights. She just
she did pick up on freedom and human dignity.
Exactly.
Right.
And that is one thing that that's one thing that the Pope always stands for, and it doesn't flow with the societal whim, I guess. There's quite a bit of pushback because of that.
Right. One of the most pithy expressions of what the Holy See's diplomacy is all about is from this guy, Cardinal Tauron. I always use it in my speeches, where he said the reason we're in the diplomatic business is to oppose and contest systems which corrode, systems or ideas which corrode the essential dignity of the human person. That gets right down to it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it does.
It does, because we're seeing, let's face it, there's a lot of discussion these days about the moral fiber. And the Pope is sort of the standard bearer for that sort of thing.
Sure. So whether you're talking about the risks of secularism to good civics over time, or whether you're talking about the heinous dictator in Zimbabwe who's ruined a good country, or you're talking about ISIS who thinks they're in the 11th century and we're trying to do a reverse crusade on us. You know, they're all the same situation in some ways.
Well, popes, historically, popes fought battles. I mean, they were formidable political figures, and they weren't there just for advice.
No, and when I give a talk about the diplomacy, I mentioned that both Napoleon and Garibaldi and the unification of Italy were almost existential threats to their diplomacy for that very reason, that they were trying to wage a diplomatic presence against a government that wanted to annihilate them, and those governments were unsuccessful, as was Stalin.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Well, in the last, let's see, what are we looking at? In the last, like, 30 seconds, minute, something like that, what did we miss? Besides everything else that was in your book.
Well, you know, I don't know. I'd like to also make the argument in the book that in addition to all the history, in addition to the role the Holy See has played and all that, I think it's very important to focus on the here and now, as you guys have all, Aaron and Bill have done, is the promise that this particular source of authority offers the world today. And that the more we can take advantage of it and leverage it with good-intentioned Western powers and secular nations, you know, Western or Eastern, I think that offers great promise diplomatically, and they're an important player in the world stage.
Right.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Rooney. This has been an interview with Ambassador Francis Rooney, former ambassador to the Holy See. We hope you'll join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Share the interview with your friends. It's been awesome. Thank you, Ambassador.
Yes, thank you for being on.
Thank you, Aaron and Bill.
Happy Sunday morning.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Israel. So we're going to move from the Vatican to Israel. You're going to like it. Be right back with you. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Redding. Hello. You're joining We the People Radio. For the second hour, I kind of said that really fast. We the People Radio.
We the People.
I was one of those. I was like a mumbler there for a second. Okay, so this is the second hour. The first hour we had on the former ambassador to the Holy See. Oh, sure, easy for me to say. So we're moving from the Vatican. Now we're going to shift over to Israel and Israel. And yes, I did say Israel and Israel. So we spoke with him last week briefly. He was sitting in a Humvee on the border of Gaza and Israel, there on the southern end. And this week, I don't know where we're going to find him, but he is the founder of the Zaka Foundation, the Israel Support Fund, as well as the founder and director of International Business Development for proactive global security. And that website is proactiveglobalsecurity.com, and post it on our website. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, if you want to call us. It's 530-605-4567. We didn't give you that number the last hour because we didn't want you to call us. We were having a hard enough time trying to figure out how to talk to the ambassador. It was kind of nerve-wracking a little bit. So we have our friend Israel with us to give us a little bit of an update on what's happening in the big world. Are you in the Humvee this week, or do you get to be at your house?
Still sitting in the Humvee.
You're sitting?
It's quiet, so you don't hear anything.
It's very quiet. So yeah. So how's, I mean, I guess you don't get to say this often, but how's the ceasefire going?
So far we have the ceasefire, but as we know the truth regarding the ceasefire, when you really know what the Islam and the Quran talks about, is you go to ceasefire to rearm and to regroup. And from what we see is that they are fixing up the tunnels we blew up.
Oh.
And they are trying to regroup, rearm. I guess the round number, whatever number it will be.
So they're not busy rebuilding the homes for people and feeding them and all that, like, you know, because there's obviously there are factions around the world and in our country who pity them because you guys are mean to them.
Yeah, no, they are not rebuilding the homes at this point, and
rebuilding the tunnels.
The tunnels, yeah. I guess the focus is the tunnels. Because, you know, the way they look at it, some can say that they won the war, you know. They're trying to say they won it. That Israel came to negotiations on the term. From the perspective of Israel, we wanted to do whatever we can to stop the rockets from coming down on us. So far, it's peaceful. The kids were able to go back to school beginning of the year. Everything normal, but we know. And we don't live in this fantasy world. Oh, we have a peace agreement, so everything will be quiet. We know what they are planning, and we see now what they are doing.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's fooled by a peaceful ceasefire. I think everybody knows they're rearming and fixing. Now, how do you know they're actually fixing their tunnels? You guys have like satellite images, drones. How are you keeping track of that?
It's called the eyes and ears.
Sure.
Yeah, folks on the ground.
You're not dealing with that big of an area. It's pretty hard to have secrets there.
Well, I would imagine there's a fair amount of people on the other side that don't want that to all start up again, and they're supplying information to help you folks kind of keep your finger on it and not let it get out of hand again. But how? I mean, what can you do to stop it short of going back in there again?
So, in the sense to really stop the building, anything that goes in from inside Gaza, we won't be able to do anything unless we go in. If we see or we hear anything that they're coming past the border, like as if towards into Israel, then we can do something about it.
Right.
But it does become a problem, and I know Israel is supposed to come out the next few weeks or so with some technology for the ground to be able to figure out where they're digging.
Oh, well, that makes sense. And did you guys know that they had that many tunnels?
We've known that they had tunnels for a long time. But the extent of what little surprise was the amount that they did in different types. You know, they had attack tunnels. They had tunnels for commercial use where they brought in, you know, cars and different equipment that they wanted.
They brought cars through the tunnels?
Sure.
What?
Holy mackerel, how big were they?
Some tunnels were big in the size, the commercial size tunnels were big enough for a container even to go through.
Get out! And so they were taking stuff from
where to where?
From your side over to their side?
No, it used to come
their
into
side?
Egypt, to the Rafia border.
Oh.
The Egypt border.
Does Egypt know that's going on?
I forget about them.
The Egyptian government knew for months and years that there were tunnels. The current administration has done some work about it because, you know, they have a little fight between the current Egyptian regime and Hamas. So they want to do whatever they can to destroy their side. But, yeah, and for a while it's been on the Egyptian side. They knew about it. They did nothing about it.
Hmm. Wow.
That's surprising because I would think that it would be in their best interest as well to not allow that to go on. But apparently their philosophy was different.
Apparently they had a little secret there. So were you guys able to blow up those tunnels?
No, the tunnels on the Egyptian side, they had to do it. The Egyptians did it.
And they did, you think?
Yeah. Yeah, they did some, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, this thing just goes on and on and on. You can never write them off, huh?
Yes. You can't write it off. You just have to keep your eyes and ears open with everything going around. And then the south border, the northern border, I mean, anywhere you look around. Right now in Israel, there's something on one side of the border that's going on.
No kidding. So you guys, at this point, you are... Like, you're functioning as eyes and ears on your side, and, you know, during the ceasefire?
No, during the ceasefire, it's the eyes and ears preparing, knowing to be prepared for the next round. It's just a matter of time now, and that's all you can do.
Sure. So, everyone in, for people who don't know, everyone in Israel... is in the military at some point. Is it right out of high school, or how does that work?
Yes. From boys are from about 17 and a half, we're called 18 to 21, that's 3 years, and girls are 2 years, yeah, pretty much right after high school.
Okay. And then they go to college after that, or is this like your college job?
No, then most, after the 3 years or the 2 years, they go to college, or they, if they want... specific position, then they stay in for a year or 2 years, you know, everyone depending on his will.
Okay, and how long have you guys done that?
How long, what, the military began?
Yeah, how long have you had, like, automatic, you know, military service or whatever you want to call it?
I guess since when the military began.
Okay, so for really forever.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of smart because it's interesting if you get into if we got into a battle here in the United States, how many people don't know how to handle weapons or any of that? Everyone in Israel is prepared to jump in.
Yeah, that's the one unique side of a mandatory military where everybody has the skill equally, some have more versus less.
What is the rules as far as owning weapons in Israel? We have our Second Amendment over here
fight for all the time.
Yeah, we have to constantly fight for, and there are certain weapons, certain military weapons, obviously we cannot have in our possession. But what about in Israel? What types of weapons can you own, or can you own weapons over there?
Okay, in Israel, the law is. You can't own a weapon.
You cannot?
But, yeah, you cannot. But, somehow, every other Israeli has a weapon.
Somehow.
And that's, the way it works is, you have to be 21 years of age to be able to carry a weapon. And you have to live in what's called a dangerous area.
Which is really the whole country.
And it has to, or you work in some type of a job that may need it, or if you finished a certain rank in the military or the police or any of the other security services,
you automatically get to keep a weapon.
So then you can keep a weapon. So a lot of Israelis carry handguns, and then we have, if you live in certain areas, then you have a backup of the military M16 or Tavol weapon that we have now to do in case something big happens.
What's designated as a dangerous area? Do they have a list of areas that are considered dangerous that you would are able to keep a weapon?
Yeah, anything that's what's called past the green line or close to the green line is considered a more high, dangerous, risky area. So that's under the designation that if you live there, you can carry a weapon.
Okay, and how far away is that from the border?
So which one, the northern or the southern? If you live on the southern border, so then most people don't carry because it's peaceful considered. Each little village town carries a gun, or they have a few of them in the village, in the town. Northern border, the same thing. I think most Israelis carry are in the country. It's considered Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, probably that fraction of the in-country carries a lot more weapons.
Yeah, I would imagine. And you always know that you might need it. We're going to come back with you in just a second. And Bill said he has a burning question, but I wouldn't let him ask it because otherwise we'd get behind, huh? So we'll be right back with Israel Stefanski. We are here on We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. KCNR, 1460 AM.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, sir, so that every mouth can be fed.
Good job, Billy. Knew this one.
Oh, I knew this one.
Of course you did. You and Bob.
So that every mouth can be fed.
Bill's ruining your music, Bob.
Sorry.
Well, that came out of nowhere. Okay, who was that?
Desmond Dekker and the Aces, late 60s. Israelites.
Thanks, giving away my age. Thanks, Bob.
Oh, you just enhanced it, Bill.
Israel and I didn't know who it was. You boys. You're rejoining We the People Radio. We have switched from our first hour at the Vatican. Now we're in Israel. So we're talking about all the variety of issues. So Bill had a question for you.
Yeah. You were saying that pretty much everybody over there has military training at some point in their life, usually starting at a young age. What's the crime situation over there with everybody having military experience and obviously access to weapons? Do you have a crime problem over there? Do you have a gang problem? I mean, we have gangs over here that are probably no different than anywhere else, but they don't have, most of them don't have military training. What's your situation in Israel?
Yeah, it's true that everybody has the training. Gang problems, I would say we have criminals like every place else. And we do have criminals that go up all the way, you know, and murder people or blow up cars, you know, to kill their rival gangs. Yeah, we do have it. But I would say overall crime is lower than probably the U.S.
Well, you guys...
And I don't know if that comes because of they're afraid maybe you have a gun or don't. That, I don't know.
Keeps everybody honest, doesn't it?
I would say, hopefully. We all hope that everybody should be honest.
Well, you do a ton of training all over the place, and I was looking on your website at proactiveglobalsecurity.com, and I was seeing the Denver Bomb Squad, battalion fire chief in D.C. and EMS in Washington, D.C. So you're kind of all over the place. You're not just in Israel.
Yes, because one of the skills that I have, so over the years that I've gotten, and I say, as an American, it's important to give back. And yes, I want to be able to train the first responder, law enforcement in the U.S., to what's really going on, what they should be aware of, and how to respond, and to understand that life is more important than product. You know, human life you can't replace. Products you could. And that's the idea. Something happens, how to faster respond and not live through the bureaucracy of who goes, who responds, who what, and who's going to pay for us if we do it, and all the red tape that does exist, and try to explain to them, guys, something that happened, we go. Payment, we'll worry about it later.
Sure.
And that's how it works in Israel.
Well, we see that here, especially with our fires. We've been having huge fires up here in Northern California, and there is always, and I don't know how much of it, I'm sure it takes some time, but to figure out who's, you know, who's the boss of that fire. Is it you know, the state or the federal government, or you guys don't have any of that?
No, in Israel, every summer we do have little fires, not compared to what you guys have in California, but there's one thing that I would say in Israel happens, and I never yet gotten an answer why in the U.S. they don't do that way. If a fire happens, we go and do whatever it takes to stop it. We don't wait for a certain amount of brush to burn or trees or acreage to burn before we can call the state. And after this, it burns more, we can call the federal government to do it. It doesn't exist. A fire happens, we do everything to stop the fire. Here in the U.S., I know they wait for a certain amount of brush, and then they can call the airplanes, and then they can call wherever they need to call. In the meantime, it's burning, and it's burning, and...
Yeah, surprise.
Home gone, threat, so...
Lost a town.
Yeah.
Well, you guys also, another thing you guys get to do over there that I think we wish we could do is profile. You're a huge thing for your security is profiling, isn't it?
Yeah, we don't call it profile.
Okay, what we call it profile.
You call it profile, we call it behavior pattern. We
I like that.
Don't profile because we see somebody, whether he's white or black or Hispanic or whatever, wherever he comes from. We don't look and, oh, because he's that, so we're going to stop him. We stop everyone. We manage to say, okay, let's say the age from 75 to 55, what are the chances that they are going to do a crime, arm, or whatever when they travel? You minimize it. They say, okay, from that age, probably none, or maybe a few, and then you break down the ages. For example, you say the potential troublemakers are always going to be from the age, let's say, of 22 to 35, just giving an example. So you know what? We're going to focus more on questioning that range of ages because they are more potential. So we do like a risk analysis to understand where the problem can come, and then focus on that and not just spend a resource on every 10th in the airport. Oh, we're going to check, even if she's an 82-year-old woman with a pacemaker or something, and we're going to check and frisk her because she's number 10 on the list.
Yeah, because I remember when we did a program with you before it ended, oh my gosh, it was January 29th of 2012. Okay, it was a pretty long time ago. Seemed like yesterday. We were talking about Homeland Security and the excessive... you know, the x-ray machines and all that stuff, and you had told us at the time that this is all kind of a waste.
Smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, nothing, and you know, nothing changed.
No. Well, you folks over there on your airport security is totally different than ours, and I can't remember the last time you had an incident in an airport, but you actually... have to go through security at an airport long before you get to the airport, don't you?
Yeah, we have a little distance. So, for example, every airport, every car that comes into the airport ground has to go through a check. You stop, somebody looks at you, talks to you, and if you have a different passenger in the car, if you're a taxi driver, then they talk also to the passenger to see where he's coming from. And just that initial check, a car is coming onto the airport property. We have the ELPs, the license plates recognition, just to know if it's a stolen car or not.
Mm.
So 3 kilometers away from the actual terminal, that's where it happens.
Yeah, and I you know, that's smart. I mean, it makes sense.
I can hear people saying, well, oh, but it's a smaller country. We, you know, we have too many airports that wouldn't work here.
Which I
think is stupid, but
okay. I've heard that question. Oh, it's Israel, it's smaller, we can do it. And I say, you can do it too. Each airport, each state, its own little country, and yes, you can do it. There's ways to do it. It doesn't mean it has to be exactly like Israel. There's so many ways. If there's a will, there's a way to make it where it's secure, not too invasive, and the idea is to make enough security that people don't realize that it affects them because you want passengers to come and travel. People realize it takes too long, it's hard, less people travel.
Well, how many issues do you find three miles away from the airport?
No, so it's 3 kilometers,
about
a mile and a half
away.
And the reason why you want the distance, that just in case if somebody with a car comes, tries to ram through the security gate, there's a distance before he has to travel before he gets to the terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives us the time to respond if in case he does.
Sure.
A thing like this does happen.
So if you think something looks funky, you pull him over and check him further?
Yes. Yes.
That cuts back on a lot of stuff. So by the time they get into the airport, the only thing that's left to check is the luggage.
Yeah, but if a car comes over and is more suspicious, or a tourist bus, sometimes they pull it over to the side and talk to the passengers, or if it's a car, and if it's not good enough, they will check the luggage before at the checkpoint, before they will continue going in. And at the airport today, in today's Israeli airport, you come, you get to the security counter, they ask you some questions, you go straight to check-in, and you keep going. The questions could be a bit more what's called invasive, because they are trying to find, to see if you're going to lie or how you're going to behave with the question they ask you. So if you are honest, you have nothing to hide, not a problem.
What else do you do there that we should be doing but aren't?
What else? For example, we have undercover agents at the airport, just in case. And the rule in Israel, nobody brings a weapon into the airport. Only those that are allowed to carry on the airport personnel, so to speak. So there's very few people that are skilled to have a weapon in the airport, just in case it's needed. Everything that we can do that will keep the airport safe and keep the flow of it. Not like the recent incident that was at NLAX where somebody came in and shot the TSA worker and then went in and did whatever he did. And me being through LAX many times, and I'm like, so many cops are there and somebody, and nobody could have done anything about it. You know, and that, like, an incident like this in Israel within 15 seconds or less, it would have been over.
Sure. Right. And we had that one. There was a lady. She got all the way through pretty much the whole thing and didn't have a ticket.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but that's exactly in Israel. A thing like this wouldn't have happened.
Right, right. Now, how do you handle, obviously, we have a huge border issue here. How does Israel cover, I mean, obviously they have a much smaller, much shorter border than we have. But how do you cover your border area? Obviously, you have crossings that have guards, but you don't have a wall that goes all the way along your border, do you?
Sure, we do.
Really?
We saw the problem. We take care of the problem. We build it.
I think you're being a little too simplistic.
Well,
there.
Well, so much makes, for that one.
No, it is. This is reality.
This makes this a little too reality. Much sense.
We saw in 2000, when we had all the suicide bombers, we saw what was happening. We put up a wall. Some places it's a wall. Some places it's a steel fence. And it's going all the way down to the border of Egypt. You can't, no games. We saw the issue. We took care of it, and we built it. Yes, there is. In Israel, we guard, in some places it's a wall, in some places it's a fence, and yeah, we guard it.
Have you consulted at all on our border, we'll just call it an issue, have you done any work there?
I've consulted, as I asked, and I said, with all the amount of money and things that are going on now, we could have built that wall 10 years ago. When the conversation started, we could have had it, built it, part a wall, part whatever, a fence, something, and you wouldn't be where you are today.
Well, see, over here, though, we have to get some engineers, we have to consult with the unions, we have...
And then we have to decide, there's
safety issues.
Don't forget the environmental impact.
Yeah, we have environmental impact. We could kill
report,
a turtle
yeah.
doing it, and, you know, I mean, it's a whole lot different here than it is in Israel. So.
No, it's not, yes, it's different,
He's
but when it comes
wise,
to safety, what? So you're going to tell the people that are concerned about if you're going to kill a chicken or something when you do it. Listen, the life of the chicken is more important than the life of the American people.
Exactly. We do. Unfortunately,
yeah,
that's exactly
in
what
California,
we do.
California, I know you have it.
Yeah. There's it's insanity. I mean, it's and I'm being a little glib about it, but it's when it comes to safety and when it comes to protecting our nation, there's no reason we couldn't build a wall, just like you said, and have it finished in a very timely fashion. But they make such huge press out of the idea that it's going to cost too much and it's not going to stop them, and you know, on and on and on. But you've done it and it works.
Well, okay.
We've done it, and it works. Yes, it costs money, and it worked. And we've seen how they've tried that. As we were building it, the terrorists needed to go further down the Israel border to be able to get around it. So automatically, the minute you build a wall, you're now pushing them to go further away if they want, if it's not built yet. But over the years, if you think of, yes, it cost a lot of money to build it. The amount of money you paid for the borders on the border, the technology that you put there, whatever you did, the U.S. government spent, if they spent, you already outnumbered the amount of money it would cost you to build a wall.
Yeah, exactly.
And if an attack or something does happen, the economics, you built the wall, it's there. The economic devastation is more than the wall.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Like
and the cost of human lives.
You might have tens of thousands of, we'll just call them children, even though we know a lot of them aren't. You might have tens of thousands of children flowing across the border if you didn't have a wall, say, for instance. Hey, Israel, I'd like to know from you, if you guys had that many people blowing across your border, I mean, what would you guys do about it?
No, we had. And that doesn't make a lot. We have in Israel a lot of, I wouldn't say Somalis, it's Iranians or people from Sri Lanka that came in to Israel to work. And they came in because the wall wasn't finished yet.
Mm.
And they came in, I think about 200,000, or maybe we have even more by now. But once the wall was up, that's it. And that even increased the government to work faster to build up the wall because we saw it can be a problem. We saw they came in. Nobody knows who they are. They say they are victims of genocide or whatever political asylum they were looking for. Nobody can really know if it's true or not.
Sure.
They started living in their own little communities. they caused in the areas where they moved in for people to leave, real estate numbers to go down because nobody wanted to live there. And then the crime between them and amongst others started going up. So there was a problem, and the people in Israel came up and said, enough is enough. So the Israeli government, first we did is to finish the wall. And then the Israeli government went to the countries from where these people came and said, would you take them back? And I don't know exactly the numbers. A whole bunch of them did go back. Israel gave them some money or something and did go back. But I'm not so well involved and know much of how deep this issue is, but no question about it that there was a problem. We look and we try to take care of it right away.
Well, if they're not coming across our border fast enough, we just import them. We put them on airplanes and fly them into different cities in our country and set up whole communities. I mean, we have huge Somali communities back east that have been moved in there by the federal government. And now, I just heard the other day that there's something like, what was the figure? It was like 6,000 foreign nationals that are over here on work visas that we can't find now. we let them in, we gave them work visas, they've disappeared, they've blended into society, and obviously, you know, you're going to have a certain amount of that when you have immigration laws the way we have them, but we don't seem to put the emphasis on security that you folks do, and I think we're suffering the consequences of that right now.
Yes, you are suffering it. Not to say Israel doesn't suffer, we have less, but we have some that come in on regular tourist visa and then they end up staying there as well from years ago. And we have what's called a unit, like you guys have ICE, we call it a different name. And we do go out and we look for them. And restaurants and hotels, you could be driving on the bus, they'll stop the bus and if they see you, they check your documents, you're not, you get off the bus, they'll take you.
Yeah.
We are doing a certain enforcement to make sure they know and to see.
So
you've
decided to be a sovereign country, and, you know, with the amount of pressure on your country from all sides and all the bad guys out there not doing that, huge risk. We face the risk, too, but we can spread it out a little bit more. We have a little more land mass, although I still think it's not a good idea. When we come back with Israel, we're going to talk a little bit more about maybe some things we could do here that have been recommended, but maybe not followed. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR 1460. Amen.
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 Freudian slip.
Amen.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Bordeaux, Budapest, Alabama, Khrushchev, Prince's Great, Hayden Grace, trouble in the Suez. We didn't start the fire, and there's always violence as the world returns. We didn't start the fire, no, we didn't light it, but we tried to fight. Okay.
Try to learn the words of that song.
It's too hard.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about the fire on the break, which prompted the song, the Happy Camp fire that's still burning up there.
It wasn't actually what prompted the song.
Shut up, Bob.
I'm good, but I'm not that good.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
It was the trouble in the Suez line.
Yeah, we were talking about world peace.
You said fire as I was typing statistics into the chat room. That fire right now is 96,869 acres. So 97,000 acres. Oh, and it's 30% contained, which is alarming. 2,600 firefighters, 78 crews, 14 helicopters, 124 engines, 22 dozers, and 34 water tenders. 30% contained. We're losing almost 100,000 acres of timber.
Yeah.
Awesome. So now that we've highlighted that
bit, and lots of smoke,
bit of stupidity.
Now, what, it'll be 60, 80 miles away from there, and it was terrible smoky last Friday. It was all that smoke going down.
You should see some of the pictures. It looks like somebody put off an atom bomb there.
Where will the spotted owls go to live?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think they're going to have a comeback.
An evergreen airplane and just dump all the water on it.
See, and part of that is extremely difficult to fight. They can't send in the big, stuff with the, what's the red stuff, you know? The
borate.
Yeah, the borate bombers. They can't send the big ones in because by the time they drop it, they've got to drop from such a high altitude, it doesn't do anything. And then you have a bunch of wilderness area. Well, we've made these rules, more brilliance, rules that you can't take dozers in there. You can't drop the fire retardant on them. You can only drop water. So, of course, it's a mist by the time it gets to the ground.
I'm not real sure where they came up with the idea of having
with hand crews.
Big jet airliner-sized planes dropping water from, God, I don't know, 5,000 feet or something.
Yeah, I mean,
by the time it gets to the ground, it's like fog.
Anyway, tough deal.
Anyway, I don't know anything about
firefighters. So there's our fire update. Okay, so let's go back. You have consulted tons of times with the Homeland Security guys. Well, Give us a couple things that you guys that you recommended, or the team you were with recommended, and that we didn't do, and why didn't we do it? What excuse did they give you?
I'll give you an example from one of the agencies that we are currently consulting, you know, in the distance, so to speak.
Okay.
And when things quiet down, they're going. And it's a department on the West Coast. Well, a lot of their intel people have been training with us, and they admitted we have a problem on how we gather our intelligence, and the city doesn't allow us to do this, and other members don't allow us to do that. We can't. So at the end of the day, what we are doing, it's called, we gather intelligence, not proactively, but as it comes in. If something happens, that's how we know something happens. We don't know anything in advance because we can't do the proactive intelligence. So at least I'm happy that they admit they failed in their way of how they do it, and they're willing to learn a new method, or the Israeli, so to speak, method. But we don't call it. We use the idea of how we do it in Israel is it's not just terrorism related. It could be criminal related. It's a focus. How can you look at your city and figure out who your troublemakers, where are your potentials? You know it. Every city, even you know where your trouble neighborhoods are in the city or the town you live in. So it's not called and you're gathering intelligence that you can't do it, you're not doing it that anybody particular, you know, there's ways that it could be done. And one of the people they have in the city are today a lot in the news for being in Syria. So it's proactive intelligence is a good thing to do. There's ways to do it, and to do it smart, and to do it right. But you're doing it for the safety of the community. You're not doing it to just have files on people.
No, and then once you have that information, you act on it.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, we keep letting, we let these guys in and out of the country. We let them in on visas, and then we don't. Did you know?
No.
I just learned Thursday, that when we have people come into this country to work, especially ag labor and people that would fall under that category, do you realize we check the I-94 form when they come into the country? They're, they can be here for up to, I think it's up to 3 years if they move from labor contract to labor contract with different companies, but they have to spend 3 months in their own country. The problem is we don't track that for them when they leave. So we know when they come in, but we have no idea when they go out.
Right.
So they don't.
Yeah, so what's the incentive to leave?
And that's not just that, it's many, many tourists that way.
Well, I think
they come in. Hotels, tourists.
They get a green card, and green means go, and they go and don't come back, and they just blend in, and that's their citizenship papers, I think, because then you hear the argument. Well, you know, they've been here 10 years, and they've been a member of the community, and they pay their taxes. They should be able to stay. No, they shouldn't be able to stay. They're not citizens.
Exactly. Do you guys just send them back? Is that how it works there?
Yes. We check. We don't send everybody back. But I don't know what the rule is, depending on what purpose they came on and what are they doing in the country. And when they came, you know, they didn't come through the border. They came just an airplane, and they came originally with their intent for what they were coming for. But those that snuck in through the border, through that, yes, they get caught, they get in jail. Israel built a special jail where to put them, and then they put them on planes and send them back home. I think they give them a little stipend or something. I don't know what the rule of the game is on that.
Do you have any idea what the numbers are for folks that, you know, they do come in illegally, they do a little stint in jail, and then they're sent back? How many of those folks actually return again? Do you know?
Nobody.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's my point.
Okay, zero.
We just catch them, and then we give them a notice to appear, and then we got to go catch them again because, you know, it's funny, they don't appear. You know, they don't come to court.
Imagine that. Well, do you guys... So you're not faced with questions like, should we give amnesty to all these people who have snuck into the country?
No. I mean, we do have certain groups that say you should give it to them, but I think the voice overall in Israel is send them home.
So no traction there.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, so if you had one message to give to the folks here... who don't, I mean, obviously we can't change everything that goes on in the government, needless to say, it's too darn big. But if you were going to give people a word of advice for their own personal security, what would you tell them?
In today's world, I would say know what's going around your surrounding, pay attention to what's going on in the world, and be more aware of what's happening. Because these things are moving now very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very fast. And right. For somebody that thought, oh, it's all in the Middle East, sure, but ISIS flags are flying now in America. Nobody thought about that. You have American suicide bombers going over and blowing themselves up. It could be your neighbor, you never know, and your schoolmates. Yeah? It's happening faster than you can think.
Yeah. And then we have... We have 9/11 coming up, and I got a real bad feeling about this one. I think a real good possibility we could be looking at some domestic violence of some kind, because it just seems like they're just trying to outdo now what they did the year before. And I don't know. You're right. Things are moving quick.
Terrorism, not domestic violence.
Well,
yeah.
Right.
Domestic terrorism.
Domestic terrorism, I should have said.
I guess if the domestic violence is on you, I guess it is domestic terrorism, though.
Yeah. No, it's a scary time, because you're right. Things are happening a lot faster now, and on such a large scale that, you know, we do have to be aware of our surroundings and aware of what's going on in the world and just be prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah, stay out of the big places. So, Israel, we hope that the ceasefire lasts longer than it usually does for you guys. We hope that you're not dragged back into war with those guys right away. And are you guys tuning up your Iron Dome?
No, it's still working.
Good. Yeah, but I mean, like,
take a chance.
Yeah, tuning it up. I mean, making sure it covers everything and is in good working order, huh?
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, good luck over there. And Israel, thanks for taking time this morning to talk to us about what's happening. And
we look forward to more updates from Proactive Global Security.
And we hope one day you can do your show directly from Israel.
Oh, my gosh, how much fun would that be? Okay. Well,
the station is there.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. All right, everybody, we're off to Sovereign Minds with Linda and Mark. Just a couple minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, here at KCNR 1460 AM, Shasta Ready.